Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's Here and Now. The biggest disruption in the U.S. labor movement since the 1930s is taking place today as major unions announce they will be leaving the AFL-CIO, taking with them millions of members and an estimated $35 million a year in dues, in addition to millions in back dues. Joining us from Chicago, where the AFL-CIO is holding its annual convention, is Tom Edsel of The Washington Post. And Tom, tell us about the unions declaring their departure.
The two unions that are declaring that they're leaving are two of the biggest in the AFL-CIO. The Service Employees International Union, run by Andy Stern, who is really spearheading this whole thing. It is the largest union in the AFL-CIO and has been one of the most effective organizing institutions left. The other union is quite different, the Teamsters, run by James Hoffa, Jimmy Hoffa's son. They also are a very large union. They have been suffering losses.
Well, you say that Andy Stern has been spearheading this, and he has long been complaining about the decline in membership and feels that he and his union have a better way of going about it. What has the complaint been about the AFL-CIO?
The main complaints in terms of substance are that the AFL-CIO has not really forced unions to merge. Stern contends that in order to compete with global companies and huge chains like Walmart or a big company like Federal Express, you have to have massive unions equal in scale to the companies that they're trying to organize, and ones that can do organizing on a national basis, not on a location-by-location basis. He says that one that John Sweeney, the president of the AFL-CIO, has not been willing basically to crack heads and force this kind of change. That's one of his big complaints. The other is that he wants to have unions that are the lead unions in different industrial sectors to be given basically exclusive rights in those sectors. So they don't have multiple unions competing to represent the same workers, giving employers an opportunity to sort of pick and choose and try to pick the weakest union.
We understand the two other unions, United Food and Commercial Workers and Unite Here, which is a group of textile and hotel workers, is also signaling that they are going to leave the AFL-CIO along with Andy Stern's group and the Teamsters. They've been boycotting this meeting of the AFL-CIO. What is the sense of the effect this is going to have on the departing unions first and then on the labor movement?
Well, what's going to happen is these groups have formed a new organization called the Change to Win Coalition. Its primary goal is to initiate organizing campaigns. Whether it can do that as a separate entity from the AFL-CIO is a big question. The member unions that remain in the AFL-CIO are very angry at these unions. They are violating the union principle of solidarity and maintaining a united front.
And we're reading that it's gotten pretty personal because Andy Stern, as you said, who's spearheading the leave-taking, is a protege of John Sweeney's, the head of the AFL-CIO.
Yeah, there are sort of a lot of Oedipal themes taking place here. John Sweeney was head of the SEIU and basically brought Andy Stern up in the organization, and Stern is now effectively trying to overthrow Sweeney. One of the big issues was that the dissident group wanted Sweeney to go, not to run for re-election again. He's 71 years old. Sweeney rejected that, and that, in a certain sense, set off this whole confrontation.
What effect is this going to have on the Democratic Party? Organized labor contributes tens of millions of dollars and workers to the Democrats. What will it mean as the Democrats head to midterm elections?
Well, just like with the labor movement, no one really knows. There's one argument that competition is going to be healthy both for labor and for the political system, that having two competing groups will just increase the energy. The other argument is that it divides the labor movement, which is a crucial arm of the Democratic Party, and that one wing will not be allowed under the law to talk to the other side to help mobilize and turn out voters from the other unions. So there's a real debate, and it's a wild card in this whole thing that no one really knows the answer to.
Tom Edsel, thanks very much.
Sure.
That's Tom Edsel of The Washington Post speaking to us from the AFL-CIO convention in Chicago, Illinois. In Iraq, Sunni politicians say they'll rejoin their Shia and Kurdish colleagues in the process of drafting a constitution. The Sunni representatives had been boycotting the Constitutional Committee after two Sunni members were assassinated last week. Sunni Arabs hold 15 of the seats on the 71-member panel. They represent the minority population in Iraq, but were once the dominant political force in the country. Passage of a new constitution is considered crucial to quelling the rising insurgency. The drafters have 7 days to present a proposal, and they insist they'll make the deadline. Alyssa Rubin is Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Alyssa, what happened today? Did these Sunni politicians who had quit the commission last week meet with the commission today?
Well, I think there were informal meetings. They were back in the convention center where the National Assembly is meeting. They didn't actually go to the Constitutional Commission meeting, but they now are going back to their different constituent Sunni groups just to describe the arrangements they've made and the agreements they've come to with the government for more security, for an investigation into the murder of their colleague last week. Also, that the committee will not declare that they've finished items in the Constitution or completed work on them before the Sunnis have really had a chance to weigh in.
Right. And we are reminded that this boycott began last week because two of the Sunni colleagues had been assassinated. What is the sense as to who was behind that assassination?
I think there are very, very divided views about that, and it depends to some extent, sadly, on whether the person you're speaking with is Sunni or Shia. There are people who believe that it could have been more extreme Sunnis who do not want to see any legitimacy given to the political process, and there are others who believe that it is more extreme Shia who want to ensure that the Sunnis are not able to make a strong case for fear that some of their views might prevail. So I think we don't know yet what the truth is. You know, both are possible.
Well, Lisa, I just want to ask you about one detail that caught my eye. There are other Sunnis who might replace the two who were assassinated, one of them driving around living in his car for fear of being assassinated, sleeping and living in his car, so he's a sort of a moving target. What's your sense of people stepping up to take those positions?
Well, what I've been told is that they do have people who are ready to take the positions. Certainly there are people who sleep somewhere different every night because of security fears. So I don't think it will necessarily, or I don't think it will have been easy to find someone, but I do think that there are people who will be willing to do it and who will want to articulate the Sunni views. I mean, these are politicians who would like the Sunni Arabs to have a real voice.
Well, there are many who are concerned about the process. We're going to speak in a moment about the issue of women's rights as it's appearing in this early draft of the Constitution. But tell us, what were some of the other Sunni concerns about the draft Constitution?
Probably the biggest single issue is federalism. And federalism in this case means the way in which the provinces will be allowed to organize themselves. Will the provinces be able to combine into regions that have considerable political power and clout? Will they be able to elect their own governments? To what extent will they be controlled by Baghdad?
Power and clout, but also oil. We understand that the Kurds who want autonomy in the north have large sources of oil, and the Shiites who want autonomy in the south, they have oil, but the Sunnis in the west
have sand, right. Yes, that is correct. But they also disagree with too much political power being vested in these separate regions, because their fundamental fear is that it will lead to the disintegration of the country, and that Iran would have enormous influence, if not take over altogether, in southern Iraq.
We understand the Sunnis are also worried about language in the early draft that declares that the top Shiite Ayatollahs play a guiding role in Iraq and that they should collectively be respected as a high national and religious symbol. I mean, that would be as if, for instance, in the United States, someone declared that a Catholic bishop in the Constitution should be respected. What has the response been to their concern?
Well, first of all, I actually think that that's very unlikely that would end up in the Constitution because it's just too sect-oriented. And while I'm sure there are some Shiites who would like that, I think that's a real minority because, after all the Kurds are Sunnis as well. They are mostly secular. That while there may be a group of Shia who would like that, it will be one of those things that falls by the wayside. So I tend to think there'll be a lot of voices against that, not to mention Christian and some of the other minority religions and minority groups.
Well, we have you. Let's touch on another report of what was in the draft constitution. The inclusion of Persians or Iranians in a list of Iraq's ethnic and sectarian minorities, and this was causing concerns to the Sunnis, suspicious that the Shiite Iranian government was somehow guiding the drafting of the Constitution through the Shiites in Iraq. Had you heard that report?
It certainly doesn't surprise me. After all, there are Iranians who moved here to live, and there are a number of them, and there are places that have gone back and forth between the two countries for many, many years. There's no question there's going to be a strong Iranian influence here. The question is exactly what kind of influence they have and how transparent it is.
Yeah. Well, the violence in the streets brings us back to the Sunnis, a minority in population but a dominant force under Saddam Hussein. They say that they need to be the dominant group again because Iraq is more stable when Sunnis dominate. Do they have a point?
Well, dictatorships are often very safe and stable on one level. They require citizens to give up a lot of rights on the other. And one of the questions is, will Iraqis eventually become so fed up with the instability, the carnage, the incompetence and difficulties of the police and the Iraqi National Guard that they really move towards wanting another strong man like Saddam? And I think there's considerable thought that if things don't change soon, and I don't know when soon is, but relatively soon, that it could go that way.
Well, soon is the deadline for the first draft of the Constitution to be presented to the country. August 1st is the first deadline. Do you think that will be met?
I would be surprised if it's met. I don't think it'll slip terribly much, but I was talking to different members of the National Assembly today, and my impression is that they expect it to slip at least some. I just spoke to a Kurd member of one of the Kurdish parties who said, you know, it's really better to get it right, and if it takes us an extra week, that's much better than having a constitution that is going to be voted down in the referendum.
Alyssa Rubin, Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times, speaking to us from Baghdad. Alyssa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And when we return, Iraqi women took to the streets last week to protest the draft constitution. Up until now, Iraqi women have been considered the luckiest in the Arab world, at least in terms of women's rights. Will that all change with the new constitution? Also later in the program, police in London named two suspects in last week's attempted bombings. And in Egypt, Pakistani men are under suspicion in the weekend's bombings at the tourist resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. Much more coming up here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now, and we're continuing our conversation about the new Iraq Constitution. Last week, an early draft was leaked, and it raised alarms because it granted women rights as long as those rights didn't trump Sharia or Quranic law. Ren Rahim Frank is executive director of the Iraq Foundation in Washington, D.C. She also served until this spring as chief of mission of the Iraqi embassy to Washington. She's in Amman, Jordan today meeting with Iraqi women's groups. Welcome.
Hello.
Well, as we mentioned just a moment ago, one aspect of an early draft of the new constitution is provoking outrage. It guarantees equal rights to women as long as those rights also uphold Sharia or Quranic law. First question, aren't there different interpretations of Sharia law? I mean, what's your reaction to this?
Well, I think you're absolutely right about interpretation, that we have different Sharia laws in Iraq. There are at least five Muslim sects, and each one of them has a different Sharia law. So the phrase itself is very ambiguous. in its interpretation. Nevertheless, I think women are concerned about it, partly because they're worried about how it may be interpreted.
Well, let's remind ourselves of why this is resonating so. We've spoken before about women's rights in Iraq here on the program and learned that Iraqi women actually have had far more rights in modern times than women in other Arab or Muslim countries. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely. In the 1960s and 70s, women were really very, very free to pursue professions, to go to colleges, to travel, to have full active lives in the public sphere. And so we do not want to see these rights curtailed in any way. Not that I'm saying that they will be, but we are concerned about that. And we do not want to go back in time.
Well, let's give us an example of how current law works in Iraq, at least up until, most recently. For instance, take the topic of divorce. Now, you mentioned the different interpretations of law. We understand that divorce is interpreted differently by Sunnis and Shias, and one interpretation is picked for law.
In the past, what Iraqi law did was pick the best, the most favorable to women. And that was an improvement on many Arab countries, which did not necessarily pick the best. Okay. So now we're not sure what the situation is going to be, whether they will indeed pick what is most favorable to women. And this is what's of concern to us.
Right.
Can I just say one thing that most people feel in Iraq, and certainly most women, and that is that the question of women's rights in the Constitution are inseparable from human rights as such. We do not see that there are rights for human beings, i.e. males, separate from the rights of women. This is part and parcel of universal human rights in Iraq for all citizens.
Well, I want to stay with the thinking of what is the current law. For instance, we understand that a Sunni interpretation of Sharia law says that a man can divorce his wife simply by saying that three times in front of her that he wants to divorce her, whereas Shia laws say that the wife and man must appear before a judge. It's considered more fair to the woman. And that's the version of the law that is used, the Shia version.
Yes, but we're not certain that this is what will happen. It may
right.
well be that each sect in Islam will have to go back to its own laws.
I want to give another example, which is marriage. And you can elaborate on this, but we understand that it's the reverse as far as favorable to women. A Sunni sect allows adult women to marry without having to get approval of parents, while the Shiites don't permit this.
One thing that I think we should be clear about is that even within the Sunni canon and the Shia canon, it depends on who's interpreting. In other words, there isn't only one interpretation, even within each sect. So it's part of this sort of ambiguous state that is causing us some concern.
But still, as the Constitution is being framed and drafted this week, do you think women are present in the process?
There are women present in the process. There are seven women in the Constitutional Committee. When I say that there are seven women, there are seven out of 71 in the Constitutional Commission. So unfortunately, they're a bit of a minority on the commission. But it really is a question of social evolution and cultural evolution, that we are faced with a cultural heritage. And the request or the demand for democracy and human rights is an attempt to bring up our culture to universal international standards.
We understand when this early draft of the Constitution was leaked, indicating that there might be less rights for women in a new Iraqi constitution, hundreds of Iraqi women demonstrated. Do you have a sense that these articles might get removed or improved or clarified?
Well, our hope is that we will be able to influence the process. This is what it's all about. This is politics. You lobby, you advocate, and you do the best job you can, and hopefully you succeed.
Rend Rahim Frank is Executive Director of the Iraq Foundation in Washington, D.C. She's currently in Jordan with groups of Iraqi women discussing just some of these problems. And I wonder, Ren, do you think your thinking is majority in Iraqi society, especially when it comes to women? Do you think women agree with you that they want more rights?
I think the overwhelming majority of women feel that they should have equal rights as citizens and as human beings. And I think this is the prevailing view. Now, do women in the same position to articulate their wishes? Maybe women have less an ability to access the media, to access the press, to articulate this position. But from my experience of working with women in Iraq, I can safely say this is the overwhelming wish.
Mm. I'm smiling as I listen to you because I'm remembering that the U.S. Constitution did not have rights for women when it was first drawn up.
Yes, but we don't feel that we need to start where you started.
Hmm. Ren Rahim Frank, Executive Director of the Iraq Foundation. Until recently, she served as Iraq's first acting ambassador to Washington after the fall of Saddam. She's currently in Jordan meeting with Iraqi women's groups. Ren, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, stories from The Edge, Margaret Atwood, David Sedaris, and others write about summer camp beyond bug spray and s'mores. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. British police today named two suspects in last week's attempted terrorist bombings on the London mass transit system. And Peter Clark, head of Scotland Yard's anti-terrorist branch, asked the public for information about plastic food containers that were used in the bombs after finding an unexploded device in a London park yesterday. Here now is Michael Goldfarb is on the line with us from London. And Michael, what's the latest word from police on the status of their investigation?
Well, Robin, at the moment, the police are at the flat of one of the men they've named, Mukhtar Saeed Ibrahim. He's the man who was pictured on a 26 bus in East London last Thursday, leaving after his bomb failed to detonate. Over the weekend, they were down in South London, and on Friday, they were in West London. And, of course, they've released the picture of this food container, which is about the size of your household blender. And apparently, all of the bombs were packed into these food containers, which were then placed in backpacks, which the would-be bombers wore. They also released a photo of one of them, a very, very clear photo from a closed-circuit camera on one of the underground trains. And the guy is strap-hanging the way you do, and he's got his backpack slung. And the amazing thing is that everybody's got their heads buried in the newspapers, which is what you do when you ride the tube on the way to work.
Right. Well, what are police saying about the connections between the first bombings, the July 7th bombers, and last week's bombers?
They believe that it is probable that they are linked in that the bombs themselves seem to have great similarities in their composition. Of course, when the bombs didn't go off last week, it was a gold mine for investigators. They were able to figure out what the compounds were. They were able to analyze how they were set to detonate, even though they didn't go off. And, of course, they haven't released details about why they didn't go off. And the best experts will tell you that it's because the chemical compounds were unsteady and had deteriorated since they were first mixed.
We're talking to Michael Goldfarb in London. And Michael, tell us the latest on the shooting last week of the Brazilian man that police believed at the time was a terrorist. British police are now saying today that he was shot point blank 8 times, not 5. I understand that Prime Minister Tony Blair has now also apologized for that shooting.
Yes, all the senior figures in the British government, the Prime Minister, the Foreign Minister, and, of course, the Metropolitan's Police Commissioner have apologized for this. What happened was the young man happened to live in a block of an apartment block that was under surveillance because they believe that some of these would-be bombers lived there. He was followed on the way to work by plainclothes policemen on a bus. He got into the underground train at Stockwell, was called on to halt. He didn't because he turned around and saw plainclothes policemen. He ran. They gave chase. And clearly, they are operating a shoot-to-kill policy at this moment in London, and they put 8 bullets into him, 7 apparently to the head.
And we understand police are saying that this is what they feel they have to do in case someone is a suicide bomber. They don't want him
Tony Blair made the same point today in his press conference, Robin. He said, and if we had failed to do it, and if it had been a suicide bomber, people would criticize the police for not being firm enough.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the boy's family have announced that they intend to sue the Metropolitan Police for damages.
Here now is Michael Goldfarb speaking to us from London. Michael, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, meanwhile, the president of Pakistan is saying it's not possible for the remnants of al-Qaeda in Pakistan to orchestrate either the bombings in London or Saturday's bombings in the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh. Pervez Musharraf says al-Qaeda sanctuaries along the border with Afghanistan have been overrun to the point where it takes 2 months for messages to move through the terrorist group's leadership. But Musharraf's contention is in doubt in Egypt, where authorities are quietly investigating whether 6 missing Pakistani men were involved in this weekend's bombings. And last night, Egyptians chanted stop terrorism at a peace march in Sharm el-Sheikh, and hospital officials are now saying at least 88 people, including one American, were killed in the 3 bombings in and near the tourist hotel. Well, joining us on the line from Egypt is Dan Murphy, Cairo correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Dan, to these missing Pakistani men, we understand that if an attack like this was perpetrated by foreign terrorists, as it is apparently suspected, it would be unprecedented in Egypt. So who are these men?
Well, we don't know. We know that they're missing. We know that they're being sought as people of interest and that they're roughly 20 to 30 years old. But it's possible that they weren't involved. And as you point out, it would be unprecedented for outsiders to have been involved in an attack like this because they stick out so much. Typically, you know, attacks like the last attack in Taba were carried out by Egyptians who blend in much better. And they, because the President Mubarak lives there much of the year, their security is very tight.
You mentioned the Taba bombing of last October. That was in a resort used primarily by Israelis. That bombing was thought to be organized by a Palestinian. Are officials in Egypt connecting Saturday's bombing to the Taba bombing?
They did. Well, they originally connected that first bombing to a Palestinian, and then it turned out that he was a Palestinian who lived his whole life in Egypt, and then they claimed there was a much bigger network of people that were almost entirely Egyptian. This time, they said very quickly that it was connected to the Taba bombing. They backed off from that since, and now with this thing with the Pakistanis, they seem to be going in a slightly different direction. Of course, it could be both, because if it was people from outside of Egypt, there's no way in the world that they did this without domestic assistance. And what we know is that it was sophisticated and well-organized and does seem to fit into the pattern of people that have had some kind of training that are linked to what I call the ideology of al-Qaeda.
But this time, as opposed to the Taba bombing when so many Israelis were killed, this time so many Egyptians were killed. How are people responding to that? And what would have been the motivation of the bombers?
If we accept, which I think we should, that this was, you know, an al-Qaeda-inspired attack, they hate the Egyptian regime. Al-Qaeda's chief ideologue, Ayman al-Zawahiri, is an Egyptian exile who's devoted to toppling Mubarak's regime. Now, it's very difficult to, attack the president directly or attack the security forces here. Tourism is a $6 billion industry in Egypt, and if you can cripple that, you can severely undermine the state. So that would have been their motive. But you're right, it's going to turn a lot of people off. The problem is, in the end, people that use these sorts of tactics aren't looking to win an election. They're looking to mobilize and inspire a radical fringe, and we'll have to see whether they succeeded in doing that with this attack.
And interesting, you mentioned election. There's one coming up.
There's two coming up. There's the first presidential election in sort of modern Egyptian history in September, and then there's probably more important parliamentary elections in early November. Egypt's going through a lot of change right now. It's certainly nowhere near democracy yet, but these are hoped to be the most close to fair elections they've had in a long time. And, what this will do to the mood in the street, we don't know. The big fear is that the government will use this as an opportunity to crack down indiscriminately on both its rare and fringe radical and violent opponents and the much bigger democracy movements here, who still have very little oxygen for which to operate in.
Dan Murphy, Cairo correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Still to come, the Syringa Tree, a white South African woman speaks the many voices of apartheid. You're listening to Here and Now. With some crossing of fingers, NASA is planning to launch the Space Shuttle Discovery tomorrow morning, even if the fuel tank sensor problem that led to the scrubbing of last week's launch resurfaces. The launch would be the first since the Columbia disaster 2.5 years ago, and many believe the future of the U.S. space program hinges on a successful mission. The current window for launching Discovery ends on Sunday, so joining us on the line to tell us more, Pat Duggins of WMFE in Florida. Pat, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And here we are again. Can you give us a brief update about what's been going on over the past, 2 weeks?
Well, it's kind of like that problem in your car that's there and it kind of goes away as soon as you go to the mechanic. They've got sensors at the bottom of each tank, and the job that it does basically is that when the tank gets low, it's almost like the low fuel light on your car dashboard, which is actually a life-saving thing for the astronauts, because once they take off, if there's no fuel in the tank and the engines keep running, they've got turbo pumps that go with like 70,000 horsepower, and if they run without any fuel flowing through them, they can rev out of control and explode, and the nearest thing to the engines is the tail rudder. And the astronauts have to use that in order to come back. So it's important that they understand this problem and they press ahead with it. And right now we're just going to see if they're right.
Right. And we know that NASA has a self-imposed rule that requires that all 4 fuel tanks be working, even though only 2 are needed to fly the ship. So it sounds as if they're willing to bend this rule.
Well, they have in the past. The official NASA term is a waiver. In other words, if they understand a problem well enough that they don't think, for example, that it's going to cause a cascade effect and you lose all of your sensors, then they might pull out a piece of paper and a pen and say, okay, we know the problem well enough. It's all right. We'll go ahead and fly anyway. They do this routinely, but then again, this is the first launch since the Columbia disaster, and they're bound to be a little bit more conservative about that.
Well, and remind us, we know the importance of the trip after Columbia, but remind us of the mission of the trip.
Well, it's a test flight, basically. When the Columbia Accident Investigation Board met and they came up with a number of ideas to make the shuttle safer, and that includes trying to come up with ways to repair damaged test tiles. That's brand spanking new. It's never been done. And what the astronauts are going to do, 2 of them, Steve Robinson and Soichi Noguchi from the Japanese Space Agency, are going to put on heavy orange pressure suits, float outside, and they're going to start pumping this material that goes by the technical term of goop or goo into some broken test tiles to see if there was damage on liftoff, like Columbia. Could someone float outside, squirt some of this goo in there, and then actually be able to make the reentry where the heat can be as high as 3,000 degrees.
I mean, just a quick question, Pat. Given that the shuttle program is destined to be closed down anyway, what is the importance of doing that walk?
Several things. Number one, they have several components that are going on to the International Space Station. This is a docking flight to the space station, and that's important for several reasons. Number one, a lot of material has been brought up from Earth in small robot Russian cargo ships called Progress vehicles, but nothing's been coming down. So for the people aboard the space station, it's getting more and more and more and more cluttered with useless items like, you know, used clothing, burnt out light bulbs, empty food canisters, that sort of thing. So when the astronauts dock the shuttle to the International Space Station, they'll bring in supplies, but more importantly, they're going to offload a lot of this garbage and basically pack it into an Italian-built cargo carrier called Raffaello and bring it back to Earth. That's job one. Then you're testing all of the heat protection repairs. That's number two. And then also, there's part of the guidance system on the space station that keeps breaking down. See, the station's only about half completed, and they have a gigantic gyroscope there that looks like a big black beach ball that spins at a certain rate of speed, and that keeps the station pointed in the right direction so they don't have to use jet thrusters. Well, these gyros have been breaking down right and left, and the astronauts on Discovery are going to bring up a brand new one. So there's a lot of construction to go, a lot of tests to go, and we have to keep the shuttles flying, NASA does anyway, until at least 2010, according to the mandate by the White House, and then after that they can retire it and hopefully perhaps move on to the new crew exploration vehicle.
Well, given all of that, what is happening down there? What are the weather predictions? Of course, for the scheduled launch tomorrow. And what's the sense of urgency, because there's this short window to reach that space station?
Well, there are 2 things that have to happen before the shuttle lifts off, and this is where the launch window and the urgency comes in. Number one, it has to be a daytime launch so that if parts rain off, NASA can see them more easily. And also, number two, the shuttle has to blast off with the International Space Station directly overhead. There's only so much propellant on the spacecraft, and it can't catch up to the station unless the station is right overhead at blast off. Both of those launch parameters occur only between now and the end of the month, maybe August 1st, and that's if NASA really fudges, and if they can't get it off by the end of July, August 1st, and they have to wait until after Labor Day for all of these conditions to occur again. So that's why it's kind of urgent for them to go.
Right. Pat Duggins of WMFE in Florida. Pat, thanks for standing by for us.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. It's here and now. It began as an acting class exercise. Now it's an award-winning one-woman play. Pamela Geen's fictionalized account of growing up white in a South Africa under apartheid. Pamela plays all 26 characters, sometimes several in the space of a few seconds, in this searing account of a white family that loves its homeland but hates South Africa's racist policies. In this scene, Pamela plays first a beloved black gardener, then herself as a child, then a policeman warning blacks to get out of the white suburbs by nightfall.
And sometimes, like magic, everyone disappears into the granny gilly bushes, up into the syringa tree, under Salamina's bed.
Police! Police! Pass! Pass!
The Syringa Tree will soon be made into a film and novel, and Pamela is currently performing it again at the American Rep Theater here in Cambridge. It was brought back after its January run sold out. We asked her then, how close is the play to the truth?
The play now is a fictional story in the end, but it is based on two true incidents. And those incidents are the murder of my grandfather on his farm, which was called Clover, when I was 10 years old, and then also a black child that was born at my house, and my dad is a physician, and he did deliver this little baby at night. We hid her away because of the legal circumstance with apartheid at the time. And so I think taking those two main incidents and spinning the story from those two really speaks to a lot of my feeling about my life there, but it's not my actual life.
But it's close enough that, you know, one's jaw drops watching you be alternately a 6-year-old, a 10-year-old, your own mother, your grandfather, your black nanny, your her child. You've written that it also produced these memories of these black women, largely, who cared for you and raised you, something you could still feel against your skin. Do I have that right?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's a memory so many South Africans carry with us, and many people in this country also. You know, I've had many, many letters from people who say, I was born in the South, I was raised by a black woman who cared for me, who I still remember the smell of her. You know, and it's so interesting, the smell of the skin and the maternal instinct of the person who cared for us as very young children, that we never forget that. And Salamina, the character, one of the main characters in the play, is based on two different women who took care of me. And I remember them as if they were standing in front of me right now.
In fact, we have a scene where Salamina, your caretaker, and Elizabeth, who is your character as a child, meet with Zephyr, who's the gardener of a neighbor. In that portion, we hear a reference to the song Shoshaloza?
Exactly.
What is that?
Shoshaloza is a traditional work song that the miners used to sing coming down from Rhodesia to the gold mines. And the words of the song are quite simple, and they really mean the little white train is bringing us through the mountains, keep going, keep going. But there's a longing in the song for the green of the hills of Rhodesia, where they come from. It has, you know, the other meaning, which is really for the black struggle in South Africa, keep going, keep going. It's the working song. It's for us to remember really what it took, all those years of resistance and all the unsung heroes.
As I hear you speak, it's reminding me that when I've spoken of your play to others, when I say that it's about the experience of a white South African, that you feel a little resistance at first because whites in South Africa were the enemy in the apartheid movement. Your play, you know, speaks to the pain of everyone involved in South Africa. Who was your family in the middle of this? What did they stand for?
I'm so glad you asked me that. You know, it's such a, as I began to write, it just opened a well of feeling in me of love for a place that I truly adored. And What's wonderful about the Syringa Tree is that it's not a political drama that sort of hits you over the head with a message of what to think politically of, you know, black or white. Or it's really a story of a family. It's an epic story spanning four generations of a family. And this could be my family. It could be any South African family. And there were many, many families like this who really, you know, tried to do what they could to help on a one-on-one basis.
And these are white families.
White families, yeah. And yet we lived in a system that dictated that we were separate from the black by law. But then on a daily basis, we were engaged in the most intimate, deep friendships with the people who worked in our homes. They were like a part of our family. So it was an extremely confusing thing. And I think it took me a long, long time to unravel it and to work it all out and to understand what it meant that somebody who called himself a freedom fighter walked into my grandparents' farmhouse that had no lock on the doors because they were not afraid of anyone. They had black workers who just adored them. Walked into the farmhouse and murdered an 82-year-old man in the name of freedom, and then trying to put that next to the children of Soweto who walked in the streets with the most extraordinary bravery to say, no, we will stand up.
You mentioned the freedom fighter killing your grandfather. How could he have known that your mother risked her life for the black child of a servant, that your father also took risky steps? So there were secrets everywhere. And deep, deep love. I want to go back to that deep love that you had for these people who helped bring you up, and then you left the country and left them behind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such a wonderful point that you make. You know, it's very easy to generalize. There were so many black people who would have felt ashamed of the man who stabbed an 82-year-old man. There were so many Afrikaans people who had hearts of gold, who worked for change, that are unsung heroes. You know, I think a lot of the joy of the play for me, and there's a lot of, you know, I just want to say too, there's an enormous amount of humor and fun and joy in the play also. A lot of it, I think, was awakened when I began to write and I started to remember just the exquisite gift of being born a child in Africa, being able to smell that air and be with those people and hear the rhythms at night and just that extraordinary life there.
In the end of the play, you go back, your character goes back to find this nanny who was so important to you. Did you do that? Have you seen these people since?
I have. I went back last year. It really was such a journey of the heart, you know. But I had this miraculous reunion where it was almost like the play coming to life in a way. You know, even now when I think of what that really meant to me, and I know from them that it meant an enormous amount to them. And Salamina and Caroline, who was my actual, like, real Salamina, said to me, "Pemi, if you could see my heart, it is white as snow that you came to find me." And just that, I mean, just the gift of that in my life, to know that I've had this chance to reunite with her. This is one of the gifts of this place. So great.
Pamela Geen's eyes still well up as she talks about that reunion. In the Syringa Tree, the last words are spoken by the character playing her nanny.
To open our heart with joy. We are free. We are free.
Writer and performer Pamela Geen. The Syringa Tree is currently being staged at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.